It's been an emotionally draining time for both Joseph, his 11 brothers, and his father. After a reunion and apparent reconciliation, the brothers are given land and jobs in their new home. For the next 400 years, the locus of activity in the Bible is in North Africa, and despite the ongoing famine, the first Israelites appear to thrive in Egypt. But not everyone has the honour and privilege of being in the Prime Minister's family. Life for the average Egyptian is grindingly harsh, and Joseph needs to manage his people's expectations and welfare while making sure that there is enough for everyone to eat. His first move is to sell some of the grain that was stored up during the years of good harvests. Such is the hunger and need that all the silver and gold in Egypt winds up in Pharaoh's coffers. Still hungry, but with no money to pay for grain, Joseph now insists that the people bring him their livestock in exchange for food. This gets the people through the next year, but when the grain which they have bought with their livestock runs out, they have nothing left to sell but their land and their freedom. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 14, Ravenous Wolves. Before we plough into Genesis season finale, I'd like to thank you for supporting this podcast. Many of us podcasters plug away in isolation with no idea if anyone is going to listen, and it's hugely gratifying to know that you are listening. You'll notice in the show notes that I put the actual Bible chapters covered in this episode, just in case you want to double check what is written in the original. The Bible I refer to is a very well-thumbed Zondervan NIV Study Bible UK edition. By now, you should be fully aware that this is the Bible minus the religion, which seems to completely miss the point of the book. Still, there's method in the madness. If the project goes as planned, a huge number of people will engage with a fabulous book which they might have previously written off. And with that, let's keep going until the book of Genesis runs out of road. In what looks like a case of placing hard-nosed business ahead of charity, Joseph takes control of all real estate in Egypt in exchange for seed. Pharaoh not only rules Egypt, he owns it. The people are now his servants. Only the priests are allowed to retain their property, as their food is provided for by Pharaoh. However, Joseph's only request from the Egyptians is that they give a fifth of everything they grow to Pharaoh, which perhaps sweetens the pill for them a little, given that most of them have lost everything which they ever worked for. Despite the privations, the people are enormously grateful for Joseph for saving their lives and pray that his God looks favourably on them. At the time Genesis is written, which is believed to be some time after 500 BC, the Egyptian law that 20% of the nation's produce belongs to Pharaoh is still in place. The book tells readers that throughout the famine, Joseph and his family thrive and their numbers increase dramatically. Jacob survives in his new home for another 17 years. Before he dies, he asks Joseph to perform the typically Canaanite ritual of putting a hand under his thigh, and his son agrees to bury the old man in Canaan. Listeners will remember that in episode 7, Abraham asked his servant to place his hand under his thigh, and it seems that grabbing a man's testicles is an Old Testament way of solemnizing a promise. Joseph vows that his father's bones will not remain in Egypt, and Genesis paints an emotional picture of his aged father. It sees the old man leaning on his staff for support, worshipping the God who he believes has brought him comfort, joy, and reassurance at the end of his life. Before Jacob dies, he spends some time alone with Joseph and his sons. Joseph has heard that his father is sick, and so he pays him a visit, bringing his two boys, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. When Jacob hears that his favourite child is on his way, he rallies a little. He sits up in bed and tells his son a story from long ago. He tells him how God appeared to him at Bethel and promised him that his offspring would become a community of peoples, and that the land where he slept would belong to his descendants forever. He tells Joseph that he sees Manasseh and Ephraim not as grandsons, but as sons, just like his other boys. However, any other children born to Joseph after this will be treated no more favourably than Jacob's other grandchildren. He mentions Joseph's mother Rachel, possibly because he still misses her. He describes how she died in Canaan and was buried on the road to Bethlehem. Jacob's eyesight is poor at this late stage in his life, and he doesn't realise that Joseph has his sons with him. He doesn't recognise them, and Joseph explains that the boys are the sons which God has given him. Jacob has them brought close to him, kisses them, and blesses them, overjoyed that he has not only seen the son that he thought was gone forever, but that he is now seeing Joseph's children too. Joseph takes the boys from Jacob's knee and positions them for a blessing so that Manasseh, the older son, is nearer the old man's right hand and Ephraim nearer his left. The right hand is Jacob's blessing hand. Joseph is surprised and disappointed that his father then reaches out his right hand to give Ephraim his blessing rather than Manasseh. Jacob tells the boys how God was followed faithfully by his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. He explains how God has been like a shepherd to him and an angel who has protected him from harm. He asks God to bless the two boys, who he said should be given his own name, a suggestion that he is adopting them as sons in their own right. Jacob asks that the number of the boys' descendants increases greatly, and as he's about to place his right hand on Ephraim's head, Joseph tries to intervene. According to tradition, it's the older son who gets the blessing, and unhappy with the way this is going, Joseph tries to move his father's hand to Manasseh. He tells him that he should bless him, not Ephraim. It's fantastically awkward, but this is no senior moment. Jacob knows what he is doing. Manasseh will become a nation in its own right, he says, but Ephraim will be greater, and his descendants will rule multiple nations. He also states his hope that Joseph will be as blessed as both his sons. And so, Ephraim gets the blessing of the firstborn, a concept that is clearly something of a movable feast in this family. Jacob was born second to Rebekah and Isaac, while Joseph was born 11th. As a final gesture, Jacob promises Joseph that God will remain with him and will bring him back to Canaan, which he refers to as the land of your fathers. He promises him one more parcel of land than his brothers, a double allotment that is fulfilled when both Ephraim and Manasseh are given shares in the carve-up that leads to the creation of Israel. After the drama of the previous chapters, the ending of Genesis feels like a bit of an anti-climax, but it is still hugely significant as Jacob effectively dictates how things are going to play out for his children and their descendants. Before he dies aged 147, Jacob gathers his 12 sons around him and lets them know what the future holds for them all. Far from ingratiating himself to his sons with a highlight reel of their best moments, the old man chooses to speak openly and honestly to each of them, telling them exactly what the outcome of their behaviour will be. His pronouncements come as a kind of final credits at the end of Genesis, and though the book describes them as a blessing, some of his children might be forgiven for not seeing it in this way. Reuben is told that he is honourable and powerful in the extreme, the first to be born and the first sign of his father's virility, but he is as turbulent as rough seas. Remember, Reuben slept with his stepmother Bilhah, and for defiling his father's bed, he will not excel, he is told. Simeon and Levi are dismissed as a couple of violent and reckless thugs whose families will be scattered across Israel. These are the two ringleaders in the revenge attack against Shechem after their sister was violated. Their anger has led them to kill men and hamstrung oxen. They are fierce and cruel, and Jacob wants nothing to do with them. In fact, when the land of Canaan is eventually divided up among the tribes, Simeon's land is entirely contained within Judah. This is seen as an effective way of preventing Simeon and Levi from teaming up to dominate the other tribes. Judah, meanwhile, receives almost as many column inches as Joseph. His brothers will praise him and bow down to him. He will have the upper hand over his enemies. He is like a young lion, and Jacob describes Judah as a fearless predator. Who dares to rouse him? He asks. Judah appears to have a royal future. Neither the scepter nor the ruler's staff will leave him until the one who it belongs to arrives, Jacob tells his son. All nations will be obedient to this leader, which has naturally caused much chatter among Christians who see Judah as a direct ancestor of David, who in turn is an ancestor of Jesus. According to the blessing, Judah will tether his colt to a tree, wash his garments in wine, and possess dark eyes and teeth that are whiter than milk. It's a fabulous forecast for a man who, readers already know, is not averse to a quick bunk-up with a roadside prostitute, having made a widow put her life on hold while waiting to marry his son. Zebulun will live by the sea, where he will become a haven for shipping. Issachar is described as a rugged donkey who will enjoy his bucolic surroundings so much that he will even pay taxes and work under foreign powers just to remain there. Dan will be a champion for justice, but will also be a snake by the roadside who bites horses and topples their riders. Jacob is now halfway through his blessing, which he gives in chronological order, starting with his oldest son and ending with the youngest. He asks God to rescue him and his family from danger, then addresses his son Gad, who will be attacked by raiders but will defend himself ably. Asher will be known for his fine food and will provide delicacies fit for a king's table, while Naphtali is a doe who will give birth to beautiful fawns, suggesting that he will flourish. The credits continue. Joseph is clearly still the favoured son. He is a fruitful vine growing next to a spring whose branches pour over a wall, suggesting fertility and an abundance of offspring. Jacob describes hostile archers attacking his son, whose bow remains steady and whose composure remains calm. He attributes this strength under fire to God, who he refers to as the Mighty One of Israel, the Shepherd and the Rock of Israel. This is El Shaddai, Almighty God, the God of Joseph's father, and who also blesses Joseph. Jacob gives his son the blessings of the skies, of the deep, of the breast and womb. He assures his son that his blessings are greater than those given by the mountains or the ancient hills, and they should rest on Joseph, who is a prince among his brothers. Finally, and in stark contrast to his blood brother, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf who devours his prey in the morning and divides the plunder among his people in the evening. For the first time, the Bible names these men as the 12 tribes of Israel, and the writer explains that each man is given the blessing that is appropriate for him. His blessings given, Jacob has one final set of instructions to his sons. He wants the men to bury him in the same tomb that Isaac and Rebekah, Abraham and Sarah, and his wife Leah were laid to rest. These are his last words. When he realizes he is dead, Joseph throws himself on his father, weeping and kissing him before ordering his physicians to embalm him. The process of preservation takes 40 days, and according to Genesis, the Egyptians mourn their leader's father for 70 days. Jacob's last requests are unorthodox ones, and Joseph has to ask permission from Pharaoh to accompany his father's remains to the burial site in Canaan. Authorization is given, and Joseph is joined by his brothers, their households, and a vast entourage of Egyptian officialdom. Only the children and their flocks and herds remain back in Egypt. The mourners are accompanied by chariots and horsemen and form a hugely impressive procession. As it approaches the River Jordan, the convoy breaks out into loud, heartfelt lament, and the travellers remain here for a week while Joseph mourns his father. The scene creates quite a spectacle as the locals witness the unexpected sight of a formal Egyptian burial in the heart of Canaan. The event is so unusual that the spot is named in honour of the funeral party. After the brothers and their entourage have buried Jacob near Mamre, they return to Egypt. The last of the patriarchs is dead. And without the benign presence of Jacob, the brothers who sold Joseph into slavery feel suddenly vulnerable. unsure of how events will pan out for them, and fully aware that Joseph may legitimately turn on them, they cobble together a plan that is not dissimilar to the child who forges a note from a parent to its teacher. They tell Joseph that, before he died, their father urged them to tell him to forgive them. There is no evidence that Jacob requested this, and he had plenty of time with the other 11 before he died to tie up any loose ends. However, family appears to mean everything to Joseph. When he receives the message, he bursts into tears, and soon afterwards his brothers throw themselves at his feet, declaring that they are now his slaves. Joseph reassures them that they have no need to be afraid. He is not God, he says, so it's not up to him to dictate events. His firm view is that they intended to harm him, but God used their plan to accomplish something good, which has led to many lives being saved. He lets his brothers know that he will provide for them and their children, and assures them that they have absolutely nothing to worry about. Joseph eventually dies aged 110, which seems premature given the great age achieved by his forefathers. He lives to see Ephraim's grandchildren, and Manasseh's grandchildren are also placed on his knee. Before he breathes his last, he tells his brothers that God will take them out of Egypt to the land promised to their father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. God will help them, he says, before making them promise to carry his remains with them when they leave for Canaan, a request which is honoured by Joshua some 5 centuries later. In the meantime, Joseph is embalmed to preserve his remains and is placed in a coffin for safekeeping. Surprisingly, given his status, his incredible management of the great famine, and his humane treatment of the brothers who wanted him dead, Genesis doesn't record any funeral ceremony, nor a celebration of his life or any mourning by his family. Still, Joseph remains one of the Bible's most powerful characters, a man far bigger than the multicoloured coat for which he is famous. With his death, the book of Genesis ends. So, season one of Holy Bible has reached the end of the road. We're one book down, with 65 to go. Prepare for a 400-year leap into the future, where the bucolic idyll of Egypt under Joseph's benign rule is a distant memory, and the white noise that permeates the dust and clay of the Nile Delta is the groaning of a million Hebrew slaves. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. In this week's show notes, I credit everyone who has inspired me or whose work has helped me pull this podcast together. Thank you, all of you. If you like the show, tell people. If not, tell me. Our email is in the notes too. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with season 2 next time.